Welcome to the Umbrella Hour. This is Dr. On, clinical sexologist with Xander Keg, licensed clinical social worker. We have a guest this hour, and our guest is Ginny Weaver. Ginny is a scholar and religious educator who confronts questions of faith, sex, and freedom of inquiry in the academy and discourses around gender ideology. Welcome to the show, Ginny.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
How do you confront questions of faith?
Faith is a big topic right now. A lot of people are, quote unquote, returning to religion, which I think is dubious. I think we have a situation when people's values happen to align with their religion as opposed to their belief necessarily. So they go to what they think of as religion, but it's really just their own ideology without necessarily having the actual religious side of it, which I would think of as being defined by belief. And I think part of that too is just the general sense of not really a vibe shift, but a lot of people have felt very stifled in other institutions. And so they might turn to the church or something like that, where more conservative thoughts are typically welcomed.
Thank you. What about sex?
Yeah, so that's definitely a thing that I think has been stifled as a discussion. I definitely think conversations around sex have been, say, fraught, stifled in institutions I've been in. I've been in academia as an undergrad starting in 2016, as a grad student starting in 2020. Those are very particular times. The so-called transgender tipping point was in 2015, according to Time magazine, declared that for us. So that was an intense time around racial discussion, certain theories about what race is, what racism is, and so on. More relevant to my interests and my experience would be what some would call the gender wars. What defines gender sometimes overlaps with what defines sex. Is sex a spectrum? And there tended to be a pretty hard line between acceptable and unacceptable speech around sex and gender. But I would say the more difficult and more important topic is sex, because that comes in with, in US law, we have Title IX, which is sex discrimination. And so ultimately, I think the question of what sex is becomes more practically important than an increasingly out notion of what gender is. So as far as that, I mean, I definitely do that on the individual level. I've found that at the individual level, academics, all the way from grad students like me to tenure track and tenured professors, they're all a lot more willing to discuss things in private. And so I've found that that can be an important avenue for just letting people know that having questions is actually common. And feeling that things are a little confusing at best with gender discourse in the academy, is being confused is fine. Being critical, even, shall we say, gender critical, is really common. And that's changed in my department over the last few months to where the gender critical type stance is pretty open and a majority. So I think maybe the fight is sort of won, at least in the teaching assistant offices. But yeah, that would be how I confront it. I haven't gotten to write on it super much, but yeah. And so I've had personal experiences with, say, gender healthcare that sort of spurred me to focus on it even more than before.
Thank you.
Ginny, I'm curious, what is the discipline that you're getting your PhD in?
English.
Okay. And so you're studying these topics from that perspective, from the lens of literature, or what in particular?
Yeah, so I use the word discourse pretty carefully because I do pay a lot of attention to online, like social media stuff, things like that, as well as the academic literary part. But especially during my master's, one of my master's theses was on trans memoirs and how we interpret those. And so that definitely gave me a look at how things used to be done for whether social transition, medical transition, and things like that. So in the academy, definitely the literary sense, but on the outside with more like the interests of the commentariat to do with like the discourse. And
are you familiar with Camille Paglia's work? Are you a fan of Camille Paglia?
Yes, I've read what's the big one, sexual persona. I'm not sure I would call myself a total fan of that. I definitely like her style. She does not mince words at all, and we need more of that, especially in the US. I think it's a little better in the UK. But I think she maybe tips too far into this mystical religious essentialism of sky god or earth mother, things like that, that I think are also not really based on current anthropological stuff. But I've actually not read her stuff on trans topics, which I think she's commented on a good bit. So I'll have to admit my ignorance on that.
Yeah, I think she's situated in maybe cultural studies or media, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not exactly the same. It's not a literary discipline, but she does do a lot of critical analysis. And so she takes on, I would think, maybe like you said, it's a similar vein, but she's a bit more frank in her way that she approaches it, which I also appreciate. I remember I think it was in the 1990s when I was in college, I was a non-traditional student, and I learned about Camille Paglia. The way I learned about her was that she was substituting as a guest DJ or showrunner. I don't know what you would call it, for Rush Limbaugh. And I thought, well, now that's odd that Rush Limbaugh, this conservative commentator, would have a very out and outspoken lesbian as their fill-in person. And she's quite funny, but I know she's very controversial. You're familiar with her work, but it's...
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've also read... She's definitely the English world. I know she had something to do with Harold Bloom, who's a major literary guy, but she does have a whole book on poetry, and which I've also read. I don't recall it that well, but it's more of student interest. So I recommend that. I think it's called Break, Blow, Burn.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, in my field, the definitive figures are, I don't know, Judith Butler, whom I have studied a good bit, and people don't always know what she actually thought about things early on. But it's fun to read. I like the complicated stuff. I do teach on religious stuff outside the university. I love like difficult to read stuff a lot. So Butler is interesting, if not agreeable to me.
I refer to it as the postmodern gobbledygook. Yeah, I mean, and she's a rhetoric professor, right? Or maybe she was. I'm not sure if she's retired now. Or maybe I shouldn't even be saying she. I think Judith is a they, goes by they pronouns now.
Last I checked, it was... they/she.
Oh, okay. That's fine then. I actually just read an article. It came out within the last day or two from the 1% Substack. Mm-hmm. And the author was Kenan Ross McKinnon, who's a trans man and a social work professor we've had on the show before. It's a very interesting article because he's talking about how when he was going through his schooling before he got his doctorate and he was introduced to postmodernism and reading Foucault and Butler, and then also depathologization efforts towards depathologizing transness and moving away from the medical model.
Yeah.
And he was talking about the recent Scarametti ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court and how Judith Butler put out a public statement arguing that they were somehow remiss in not following the medical authority. He was a bit puzzled by it. Yeah, I'm a bit puzzled by it too, because there does seem to be some shifts that have happened, which happens over time. Yeah, but it's for sure. One thing to make a really strong argument against the medical model, and then all of a sudden, a couple decades later, make a really strong argument for the medical model. That seems a bit out of character for people who are more into queer theory and postmodernism.
They're not really removed from evolving their own stances on matters, right? Maybe many just don't go there for a lot of reasons.
Yeah, but typically you'd see an evolution. There doesn't seem to be an evolution. It just went from one to the other without at least that's what I'm grasping from the article. I might be totally wrong.
So I've been wishing to write on this for a while, but I haven't yet. But interestingly to me, the evolution of Butler's thought was basically she stopped writing on gender stuff in maybe 2004-ish, went to political theory, which is actually pretty good, in my opinion, hers, and then came back in the 2020s to the gender topic, almost with her own pronoun, announcement, but interview. So what seems to have happened, and this is, I won't get into biographical speculation, but after Bodies That Matter in the late 90s, the sequel to Gender Trouble, and actually I'd say the more important one, more important book at this point. After that, there was a lot of backlash where her early theory does not account for gender dysphoria at all. You're locked into your gender. There's no non-binary. This is not a very contemporary thing. So a lot of trans scholars, people like that, really pushed back. I think Jay Prosser's an early one. And it wasn't really a cancellation effort. I think typically that wasn't happening at that point, unless you're J. Michael Bailey, who did get some semi-non-internet canceled. But in the case of Butler, I think wave of criticism, which kept going, led her to move away from the topic. And then her more recent book is just like, I'm not even going to propose a theory of this. She says, trans and materialist scholars basically refuted performativity theory, which was her early one. So now she's just sort of like, without naming the counterarguments, moving on. There is this gap of over a decade where whatever evolution happened, happened. But I think there's a trajectory considering her work in the context of other people's criticisms. I think it's fairly easy to see criticism led to the change later. That's my soapbox on Butler. But I read a lot of Butler. That's one thing with difficult to read stuff. The more of it you read, the more resistant you are to thinking it's irrelevant because you've, you know, you sunk cost fallacy or something. It's been rewarding for me to read Lacan, who's pseudoscientific nonsense, but it's been rewarding because it's fun. So I think the same thing can go with Butler for me. But I will say, in her defense, her mid-career political writings are really well written, really clear, and I think useful. So I'll be terminally nuanced on that.
You indicate that not only do you confront questions around faith and sex, but also freedom of inquiry and gender ideology. So what are some of the things that you're confronting with regard to freedom of inquiry? And then we can move on to gender ideology and how you define gender ideology. And why you're interested in that in particular.
Yeah, so I'm a big fan of academic freedom. I mean, Heterodox Academy, I think I'm technically still a member there. Don't speak for it, obviously, but I'm a fan, and Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression and so on. So I like those. But I think a good example of what I like to do in the academy, as far as freedom of inquiry goes around gender, would be this little talk I did, a brown bag talk last semester or the semester before. It was very sparsely attended because we scheduled it badly, but it was on basically big proposals for trying to course correct academic feminism. And one of the things I bring up there, there's a list of points that I made aside from the background on what happened to certain even slightly dissenting feminist scholars, such as Kathleen Stock is a good example, getting forced out of her academic career, basically. But one of the points I make is stop using activist tactics to resolve intellectual disagreements. And so I've been pretty open about that, even at my university where I gave this talk at my university, but I'm a big advocate for changing, maybe even getting tactics out of the question and just doing what we do, which is look at the questions honestly. There's a disagreement, publish a rebuttal or whatever. And this goes on in other fields, right? And so I think if someone publishes an opinion with which we disagree, look at the evidence, don't start with our conclusion, and then publish a rebuttal. We also have other resources like Substack. We can get out opinions really fast as opposed to just going through the review process. Ideally, the review process would be better, but if you just want to reply in the moment, you can do that easily without necessarily engaging in ad hominem attacks and things like that. So that's generally that's a track I go on in increasing freedom of academic inquiry around questions of gender. I think a lot of people start with conclusions. A lot of people let very young activists, potentially from even Tumblr, their conclusions, and then refuse to backtrack to evidence. So I think it's almost just a behavioral switch. It also comes down to publishers. Publishers, frankly, put out some pretty bad stuff. I'm interested in the topic of, like, what do academics want? Why do academics sometimes fall for stuff that the average person wouldn't even? It essentially comes down to confirmation bias. If you find one thing that maybe suggests something you like and that outweighs stuff in your mind, It's a lot of mindset change and perhaps publishing change. And I do also wonder about, journalists are often held to, especially state-funded types of journalists, I don't know, PBS or whatever, are held to pretty high standards as far as their public behavior. I don't want to sink academic freedom, but that's something I also can't help but think about. I work at a state university. Maybe I should be beholden to at least standards of decency or something. That's something I'm still teasing out. I wouldn't make, here's my policy proposal, but it is something I think about. And then you had also asked a question about gender ideology.
And let me ask you a follow-up really quickly about what you were just saying, because I'm curious what the response was, because the idea of demonstrating through evidence has been criticized in a lot of different ways. And standpoint epistemology or lived experience has been emphasized to as a type of replacement for evidence, right? So evidence in a courtroom, right? That people take issue with that, evidence for arguments. And so I find it really interesting that people in the academy would be arguing against evidence.
Yes.
So I'm wondering how people responded to your ideas.
So that particular talk, not many people did attend, but then I spread it around through group texts to people who are curious. And the response was, there was no heated argument against it, because I think we're past that point at my university, at least. But there was either, this is troubling, the information I presented, whether it's about Stock or anybody else, was stuff they maybe had avoided hearing about or something. So I think there was some reconsideration among the people who might have disagreed, of more of like a little bit of pondering facial expressions, let's say, rather than irritated. But then for the most part, people are happy with it. People either agree, or that they maybe disagreed with one or two things that I had said that I don't remember off the top of my head. But for the most part, they're like, yeah, let's stop shunning people for disagreement and hone our own arguments. Because the question of evidence is interesting, because sometimes the evidence needs to be a sound, logical argument. If you're in philosophy, you don't need evidence to make an argument about symbolic logic or something. So sometimes argument doesn't need to be super empirical, but there needs to be some kind of argument about most things. If somebody raises a point, there should be at least a willingness to argue within some bounds. I mean, flat earth theory, a lot of people on YouTube have posted refutations of that. So if somebody brings that to a geology or astronomy professor or something, I don't think it's on them to, like, I'm going to publish a rebuttal to this student who went down a rabbit hole on YouTube. But on questions that are clearly of public interest and contentious and so on, especially when it just comes down to definitions, there needs to be some willingness to back up your point. That doesn't even start from the point. You have to go back and then figure it out from the evidence.
So I know this is... We've always, in my opinion, had a little bit of McCarthyism. There was a time where artists were called out and accused of being communist, and in addition to a number of other things.
For sure.
But I don't think we've ever really quite moved away from that. So now we have the public doing that. Zander talks about this quite a bit, the cancel culture, because he's had it happen to him. I can't say that I've experienced it per se, but I'm seeing it in a sense where I can't really prove it. So, for instance, my posts aren't receiving quite the attention that they received previously, and that's how I'm paying attention to it. Again, there's no way for me to say, oh, this is why.
Right.
Because you're seeing this stepping up to acknowledging that some of this is changing. And I know you've mentioned what you contribute that to. Is there more to it, you think?
More to like the shift in my university and stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, well, for one thing, I think smaller state schools are in a really good position to seem better in comparison to Harvard or Columbia. And so I think that that's a good thing for high level faculty and stuff to think about. And I think they are. But I do think also that the game was up in November here, the presidential election, President Trump won. And there was just a visible exhaustion among a lot of people at school right after that. And it wasn't exhaustion of like oh, you know, we've been fighting this so hard on Twitter or X or whatever. It wasn't quite that. It was, I think a lot of people had the sense of what we've been trying to do has perhaps backfired, has irritated people. And the people who've always been most vociferously McCarthyite about enforcing more leftist politics on campuses, they haven't gone away, but they have certainly lost their cancel power. And then, yeah, like in my department, I think it was often a sense of, oh, what we've been doing was actually deeply unpopular. Something happened that we didn't expect. I expected it, but most people did not expect Trump 1 or Trump 2.
You are listening to The Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Kagg. And our guest this hour is Jenny Weaver, scholar and religious educator. Jenny confronts questions of faith, sex, and freedom of inquiry in the academy and in discourses around gender ideology. You can check her out on Substack at Virginia Weaver or Blue Sky at jennypenny.bsky.social. We're grateful to our sponsors who support our program and therefore always grateful to play their commercials. Don't go away. We'll be back shortly.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries
and cream. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our first commercial break. You are listening to The Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Kagg. And our guest is Jenny Weaver, who is a scholar and religious educator. Jenny confronts questions of faith, sex, and freedom of inquiry in the academy and in discourses around gender ideology. We hope that you've enjoyed the conversation so far. Let's get back to where we left off.
And so I think there was a sense of they failed. And it is the public. The public does have a lot of sway, especially in institutions that have public funding, for better or worse, are literally accountable to the public. Accountants there are looking at public money. And so, yeah, I think there was a sense of things have failed. But I also would say the purchase and then decline of Twitter, which became X, removed a lot of power from the more discourse warriors, because that was so big and so professionally important for the academics and the journalistic world, that I think that Twitter being disrupted as a cancel-y space actually worked to remove some of the power of cancel-y stuff. And now they're on Blue Sky. Like there's a couple of journalists I follow who have said that everybody who doesn't like them has blocked them on Blue Sky, so they actually have a pleasant experience. So I think, yeah, a lot of the more cancel-y people are a little more cloistered than they used to be because of the public's opinions being so clear, and because of changes on social media, they are just a more isolated, neutered force.
Jenny, why don't we jump into talking about gender ideology and what it is you mean by that? The listener will have heard gender ideology. People use that phrasing all the time. But if you're confronting it and you're asking questions, maybe you can give us somewhat of a definition or description that can be helpful for people to understand, and what it is about gender ideology that you feel needs confronting.
Yeah, so I think the discourse around it definitely needs confronting, but the topic itself of what constitutes gender is a topic that you could need to dive into and not just have a stance on. And so when I use the term gender ideology, I think a lot of people associate it with gender critical stances, and people tend to use it nowadays to refer just to the idea that gender is identity, your gender is what you say it is. But I think it used to be used more broadly in the sense of fixed ideas of gender. And so when I use it, I don't know, I posted something the other day about Confederate gender ideology, right, which was hyper-conservative in the Southern Confederacy back in the Civil War. And so they had a gender ideology. They had an ideology of gender that they functioned under that was very much the, well, specifically the white woman is the angel in the house, the manager of a household who's soft and so on. And so it's a very binary and essentialist thing, but it is still an ideology to me. That's an idea of gender that they were swimming in all the time. I specify white because they didn't have the same ideas of Black women's femininity. But yeah, so I think any idea of what gender is a gender ideology. And I think limiting it to just a gender ideology with which one disagrees is a little bit, if I'm disagreeing with gender identity ideology, well, I probably have some sort of ideology or I'm looking for one. And so when I talk about confronting it, I want to look at it from a bunch of different angles. I want to criticize it when I think it's wrong. Like I would say the Confederacy was pretty wrong about that, among other things. I also think that the hardline identitarian activist side, I also think they're wrong, if not as bad. And so, yeah, I think confronting, not necessarily in the negative sense, I want the discourse around it to happen. And I also want us to honestly look at the questions because they're pretty important questions. Even if I don't think it's as important as sex, it definitely bleeds down into that, however incoherently.
When you made a comment about another type of gender ideology that is equally troubling, can you describe what that looks like? So you gave us the really good example of the Confederate type of gender ideology. What comes up for me would be something around some religious cultures, ideas about men and women, right? And it's a type of ideology because it's strictly enforced.
Yeah.
And so what is an example that you can give us from, say, the opposite side that's making an argument about gender, but it's still ideological?
So like the contemporary, more conservative end?
No, on the more progressive side, perhaps.
Oh, I see. I see. Yeah. So I think the idea of gender is just what you say it is, it makes terms almost useless. So if gender is just totally independent and there can hypothetically be, what, 7 point something billion people, hypothetically, all of them might have different genders by that. And so gender ends up devolving back into, well, what, sex or nothing. And so then you're back at square one, pretty much. Which, interestingly, if you're thinking about post-structuralist theory or whatever, I'll go back to for a second. The theorist Baudrillard, he talks about everybody becoming trans. And so I think, yeah, once everybody has potentially different genders, well, gender doesn't really mean anything because it's just personality. And so I would say that that's not a particularly useful way of thinking about it, but particularly when it gets overlapped with sex. So the idea of what identity you have determines your sex. Well, then what exactly does sex mean at that point other than a personality trait or something like that? And so, yeah, then you see cases of Scrimeti. And so to me, being transsexual, instinctively, I'm very, I don't know, 1980s about this. Being trans, you have gender dysphoria and you do stuff to treat it. That's not popular anymore. But when you reduce it to identity, then medicine, operation, and so on becomes cosmetic. And so as far as real world bad effect, I do think what I would specify as gender identity ideology has had some pretty concrete harms, I guess I would say. I'm resistant to the use of the word harm when it's very vague. But in this case, I think we are seeing a little bit of the actual backlash that can lead to in healthcare decisions, general public attitude, and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. Before we hit record, you had mentioned that you wanted to talk about an experience that you had working in a medical office. We're not going to go into great details about it other than what your experience was. So I'd love to hear more about that.
Yeah, and I think that definitely relates to my thinking about all this, the ideology, especially the issue of trans-identified youth was a big part of this whole experience for me. So yeah, a couple of summers ago, I was looking for summer jobs. I ended up getting one at this doctor's office that wasn't technically a gender clinic, but it wanted to be. So one of the first signs that I had of this is going to be strange, and then it got worse to where I was losing sleep over it. The first sign that it was strange was I was the secretary, so I wasn't actually back in the offices. I could see records, which was an interesting resource too, not to actually draw from, but just to see trends. But when I was first being trained, obviously the phone is important when you're a secretary. We didn't have the live chat thing. Otherwise, I'm sure the shy people of the world would have preferred that, but I had to use the phone a lot. And so we had this dialogue tree, basically. So this was not a gender clinic, but wanted to be. And we wanted trans patients, but this would show up on recommended practices on people's insurance who were just looking for a general practitioner. And so what I would do and what I was told to do was if somebody was calling to inquire about becoming a new patient, I would say things that weren't lies, but it was like, we prioritize gender-affirming care, which is technically true. And then there was a dialogue tree from there. So, well, what if they say, but my insurance showed me and so on. That would, I think, typically dissuade people or just have them float off into the ether. And so I don't think any of that is off limits in any technical way, but it was a sign to me of this place has this an unusual relation to the truth, basically. And so the longer I was there, I got to see a very wide cross-section of who are trans people in the non-major city South, which is an obscure topic. If somebody's been reading about trans stuff for the last couple decades, most of them were heterosexual using sex-based terms, XY people mostly into XX people and so on. But there were also a lot of youth who went there. So I got to observe who is accessing that care firsthand. And I won't go into, you know, every single instance, even though there's a lot, but there were two siblings who were, again, sex-based language, two double X chromosome children. And they were male presenting. I would have probably thought they were boys in just if I saw them in public, but they're siblings. They were either close in age or twins. I never really checked that closely. And that I hadn't thought about the topic of trans youth that much until that moment. What exactly are the odds of this? I'd always thought of gender dysphoria as a very rare thing, which I think it probably is. And so that made me stop and think, this isn't hereditary. I don't know. It gave me pause, at least. I wouldn't say, oh, neither of these kids had dysphoria. They just got the social contagion or whatever, because I don't know. I don't know their little hearts. It made me sit back a little bit and go, what am I doing by these very carefully timed Lupron deliveries? So it was, a lot of the work there was, well, getting people their ADHD medication. That was a lot of work. A lot of phone calls about that. But also a lot of, is the Lupron, for listeners, is a puberty blocker, I guess would be the best way to describe it. So that there was a lot of minor stressors of, are we getting that in time for one kid or both these kids to come in and get their dose? And so I started to think of, I don't know that what I'm doing here is right, and I'm not seeing any reason to think it was wrong at that point. I started morally questioning what I was doing in those situations, even though I needed the job. My funding does not include the summer, so I did need a summer job. I'm grateful that somebody gave it to me, but that definitely led me to realize something interesting is going on with this youth conversation. I'd heard of it. I'd already written my master's thesis on trans memoirs, but they were from the 60s through the early 90s or so. I'd not heard much about the the youth conversation. And right around then, Abigail Schreier's book, Irreversible Damage, dropped. And there was all this controversy over this. And so that did alert me to this is a topic that's not really people I know or people with whom I have professional connections don't want this really brought up as a question, even though I started to have them myself. And so I never became an activist on that count specifically. But it is difficult to see these, say, trends in the numerical and not like social sense. It's interesting to see them play out. Although I will say like, a lot of people talk about how most female people who go into transition, most of them seem to be attracted to men. I would say at this particular place, the vast majority were only attracted to women. I don't know if that's at all reflective of broader statistics. But yeah, and then aside from just the trans population in the area, the employees of the place were very well-intentioned and they were very kind to me. But they definitely enabled the attitude of fear among trans patients. This place was a hub of the trans community in this city. Everybody in the community has a bad story about going to this place, basically. And I remember one time a non-passing trans woman came in and she was, can I use the bathroom? I don't have an appointment, but this is the only safe bathroom in the city. But then somebody else was like, yeah, I know, you know, we have so much further to go. And I don't know, I can use the bathroom, whatever. So there was that communal sense of fear. And then there were also other things of the doctor being super late, appointments running multiple hours behind, the general managing the manager difficulties. But I also remember thinking, and I confirmed this with patients later. I mean, if I run into a trans person around here, they were former patients there, unless they moved here since it closed shortly after I worked there. They seemed at this practice to want to keep trans women patients coming in every 3 months indefinitely, at least from what I could tell, which for working there, especially, I definitely looked at the WPATH standards of care, which I double checked, but they seemed to say every 3 months until a stable dose is reached or until there are no discernible medical issues and then broaden out. But that does not seem to have been what they did there. So a lot of my calls were just cold calling people. Reminder that you need to schedule your appointment.
Because I remember in the first year of being on hormones, they had me come in every 3 months because they wanted to check my blood levels to make sure that I'm getting a right dose. But then after that first year, I went to annual visits for a short period of time and then every 6 months. So for the last maybe decade and a half, I've been doing every 6 month visits with the endocrinologist. So it is interesting to, I don't know if that's a billing issue. You get more money if people come in every 3 months. You also are holding people's prescriptions hostage.
Oh yeah, for sure.
So that's a little strange.
Yeah, it is a requirement or they could potentially lose their license. They have to have the ability to say, well, I didn't wait a whole year because a lot can happen in one whole year. Not everyone's very good about calling the physician and making an appointment when issues arise.
Yeah.
And it may seem that it's a billing issue or more money is filtered in. But at the same time, there have been questions about physicians not scheduling people every 6 months.
Yeah.
What I wanted to mention as you were talking is that it's so difficult to know anything at all at this stage, because I think we went from one extreme to another. And what we really need is more research.
Mm-hmm.
I've had physicians say to me, we have the research. We have the research on the intersex population.
Yeah.
We also have disputes about who is intersex.
Yeah. Right into that. Yeah.
And we have such variant reports on disclaimers that we have a few types versus the extreme of 880 variant types. I don't think we really know. Also, we don't have enough data. We can obtain the data. When I look at research, I tend to go to attorney sites. You'll see reports of lawsuits filed, and then you get more of a sense of what's going on. But you can also go to insurance sites. They have actuarial studies, and we need access to it. The general public needs access to that information. I wrote a chapter for a book. It's a book on health, and it was really eye-opening for me. because I couldn't find a lot of the data that ordinarily would just pop up if I were running a query honing in on the informed consent, because I've been a critic of it. Mm-hmm. Not having the ability to determine morbidities, actual mm-hmm. cases of morbidities. And that bothered me. And I thought, why aren't we able to access that just running a query? We should be able to have that ability. Mm-hmm. Now you're seeing more of it, but initially that was not the case. So you're in that position, and of course you're limited as to what you can access. Mm-hmm. May either thwart what you were assessing, or maybe part of you was also paying attention to the office dynamics, the culture of what mm-hmm. was going on the inside. And I think that's important too. We don't have enough information about that. That needs to be written about, this pressure to conform.
We will be taking our second commercial break. You are listening to The Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Kagg. Our guest this hour is Jenny Weaver, who is a scholar and religious educator, who confronts questions of faith, sex, and freedom of inquiry in the academy and in discourses around gender ideology. Let's take our second commercial break. Stay tuned. We'll be back shortly.
The station that makes you feel good.
Optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list? Then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one super supplement brand, help you achieve that in the most convenient and comprehensive way possible. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health, sleep, emotional balance, and more. Benefit from the power, purity, and positivity of our award-winning powder sachets or our therapeutic capsule range. Use code RADIO15 at reviveactive.com and save 15% off today. Super supplements for a super you.
Cappuccino, latte, Americano, flat white, macchiato.
Just imagine, for less than the price of a single cup of coffee out on the high street, you could enjoy an award-winning online magazine every month with up-to-the-minute information on health and healthy lifestyle. Sounds like a good trade-off? Check out Health Triangle magazine on the UKHealthRadio.com website. Just sacrifice a single cup of coffee every month.
Let's all put health first.
The station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our second commercial break. You are listening to The Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Kagg, and our guest this hour is Jenny Weaver. We also want to remind you to check out our website, theumbrellahour.com. Let's get back to where we left off.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there have been a few people who've written about working at gender clinics proper, not just wannabe ones. But I do think the big gender clinics get a lot of attention. WPATH as a whole gets a lot of attention. But what's actually happening in small southern cities is not just one question. These questions around youth gender medicine, accessibility of research, availability of opportunities to dissent. It's not just New York City that's having these concerns. But the research I was doing at the time was difficult, very limited, because I have academic databases, but I wouldn't say I was super trying to dig into the literature and so on. I love statistics, weirdly. I was almost a statistics major in undergrad, which is an unimaginably different path in life. I maybe would have been an actuary if I'd done that. But more what I was seeing was around rapid onset gender dysphoria, which was a big debate at the time. Based on what I've seen and read, I think it's a bit of a misnomer. So that would be a topic for maybe a different time. I'm not sure dysphoria is what's being rapid spread. I remember thinking definitely anecdote isn't all that useful. I think until shortly before I worked there, they'd had an in-house therapist, which I think is actually a really good thing to have. I do remember also thinking This is a big topic, any kind of gender medicine, especially for kids. But I had an experience that made me realize, I think I mentioned this, one-on-one people are more willing to express themselves. So the previous semester, I'd been in a class with a friend of mine, and we were discussing something to do with trans stuff. I was 22 in academia in the humanities. We were discussing trans stuff. And so at one point, I'd mentioned something about parents, how they respond to their kids being trans. Now, what I meant was growing up to be trans, basically. I wasn't really thinking of the child gender medicine debate. But this friend was in the class, and partway through the summer, we got coffee, and she was almost concerned that I believed in the belief that youth gender medicine is a great thing that everybody just needs to accept. And I had to pause in that moment and think, well, what is my answer there? It's not actually what I meant in that moment, which was easy enough to explain. But I don't know, being outside the medical profession, I've read the reports that are massive scale meta reports on the research, CAS, and reporting on the new US one that was superfluous. But I don't know if there's been a ton of research published in the last few months. I wouldn't really know. And so it's hard for me to form a huge stance. From what I do know, being in the academy, either in this, I don't know if you'd call them whisper networks or listservs or something, but it seemed like from the activist left type side, there was a suppression of people's willingness to even look into the topic too much. And I worry about that much more powerfully now on the right. If we need more research and kids are experiencing distress, are we just going to have no kind of treatment? That's a concern for me. So that moment of getting coffee and thinking on the spot, I don't want to give a nonsense answer that makes it seem like I have a solid answer, but I still wrestle with that. And I also try not to let either my anecdotes or what I see on Substack. There's a lot of anecdotes that can go a lot of different ways down to the confirmation bias.
I think the alternative of no treatment at all has the same problem as treatment on demand, right? And so my hope is that what ends up happening is what they did in Utah. They called it the Utah Compromise, where they said no more medications, right? No more surgeries, but then they put $1 million into a fund for mental health and psychosocial support, right? So providing therapy and also providing psychoeducation to bolster the resilience of these young people who are going to need to go through puberty and need to, and how to navigate that. Almost all trans people did prior to not that long ago, right? We went through puberty. And there, of course, there are considered to be negative outcomes of puberty for some people. I don't think puberty in and of itself is a disease or an illness. And I think that's how people are talking about it now. So my hope is that we don't go from an all to a nothing, that we meet there in the middle with the psychotherapy and the psychoeducation and all of that and the psychosocial support. And I hope that's what's going to be happening.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, so I think it comes back to me being terminally moderate. I think I have a repulsion from absolute answers.
You mentioned you were doing some more writing. Can you talk a little bit about that?
My academic writing is mostly about religion and literature. So pretty obscure topics in Jewish literary history. But I do write a lot on Substack, some about religion, but also about discourse. One thing I wrote a little while ago was about moderates need to stop beating dead horses when we talk publicly. Yes, we, all of us moderates, have an orthodoxy. But yeah, I have a couple of posts coming up soon about current conflicts on the left over what femininity means. And so yeah, some of it's pretty relevant to gender topics.
Do you want to mention where people can read some of your writing?
If you just look up Virginia Weaver, that will come up. I also have a modular digital textbook that I'm going to start posting parts of soon on there. And that's under another of my newsletters.
I want to thank you for coming on our show.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
It was a great pleasure.
We have come to the end of the Umbrella Hour. We hope that you do check out our website, theumbrellahour.com. We hope that you enjoyed this hour with Jenny Weaver. And Xander, unfortunately, had to run off at the very end of closing out our show. Until next time, thank you for listening.